Gator, let's take a moment and say thank you to our sponsors at Fuji Sport.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've been working with us for a very long time, not only on this podcast, but also at the Academy. And I'm taking a peek at their website right now, and they have a brand new ultra light gi. Now, this is mind-blowing. I'm looking at my size. A2 is 2.75 pounds. I mean, that's under 3 pounds. That's mind-blowing.
I could even lift that. And go to their website, fujisports.com. Check it out. Anything you could need for your jiu-jitsu journey, you can find at fujisports.com.
Hey, it's been a while since we started Roll TV Project.
It's been a while since you started it. I did come in later, and I can't say enough about it, especially the new platform. It's really amazing, fully customizable, and you know a little bit more about the structure.
Well, so two things you need to know. One is the subscription service, which is $9 a month. You can get access to hundreds of videos, hundreds of drills, techniques, and so on, in a very nice library categorized as you need them. But two different lessons. You can actually purchase those individually, and you own them, so the subscription is not tied to it at all. You can look at things like spider guard, half guard sweeps, half guard chokes, folding pass, and so on. There's so many of them out there. So take a look and see where you need help with the videos, right? 30%. If you type in Roll Radio as a code.
Who doesn't like saving money? Go to rollacademy.tv. What's up, everyone, and welcome back. If you haven't already, please remember to hit the like, share, subscribe, download, listen, and whatever other button there is, and leave us a review wherever you do listen. That ensures that we can continue bringing you the great guests and amazing content that you have come to expect. And don't forget, go to tapcancerout.org/tournaments to register for the remaining tournaments of 2022 and for Global Grappling Day taking place on December 17th. Tap Cancer Out is aiming to donate another $1.2 million to its 10 beneficiary organizations. Fundraising and registration are open for all cities and dates. So again, head to www.tapcancerout.org/tournaments to find your city and sign up. On today's episode, Leah Stumpf of SBG joins Thomas to discuss who she looked up to as she moved up the ranks at Straight Blast Gym, her perspective on females having no choice but to train with men, her transition from traditional martial arts to jiu-jitsu, and a ton more. Here's the Roll Radio with multiple master's degree holder, 2018 and 2019 IBJJF Masters World's Black Belt Gold winner, fitness and jiu-jitsu coach at SBG Kalispell, Montana, and first degree black belt under Matt Thornton and Travis Davison, Leah Stumpf.
Welcome to Roll Radio.
And we are live. And another week goes by, and unfortunately, Gary's still not with us. He's not feeling well. I talked to him about half hour ago. He was not up for the conversation just yet. He's recovering. We wish him the best, and he is missed, so let's hope that this episode goes well. Despite some of the technical difficulties we had just a moment ago, we are back online, life is good, and Lee is in the house. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining me. There's no us. Thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I mean, one of the pioneer females in jiu-jitsu. Is that good terminology to associate with your name?
I wouldn't consider a pioneer, maybe within SBG, within Straight Blast Gym, my gym that I've trained from white to black. I would say as one of the very few women that was in that organization to begin with. But there was a whole generation of black belts before me that were competing at Worlds and kind of crossing those lines. So I'm kind of second generation, I guess.
Yeah. And we had a few guys from SBG on the show, and what a great and phenomenal organization that you guys have created. What makes you look up or as you were approaching to the black belt? Let's just talk about the few, the color belts. What made you look up to other females as you were maturing up in the jiu-jitsu, as you were creating this library and developing this jiu-jitsu intelligence, if you will, what was one of some of the things that you were looking up to other females?
Well, the first female black belt I encountered was Lily Pagel, and she was the first female black belt within Straight Blast Gym. And she's just a remarkable person. She's, you know, probably just over 100 pounds. She's from Japan originally and had a judo black belt and started jiu-jitsu at 50, got her black belt at 60. She did MMA, and she's just an extraordinary person. She's been a celebrity chef. She'd been a high school guidance counselor. She owns a martial arts gym. You know, she's just kind of done it all. She'd been a food critic. And so that was my first, you know, black belt I met. And you kind of had to be sort of extraordinary to want to stick around in that kind of environment, especially being as small as she was. So seeing her as my first example, I was like, you can have this really full life and still be good. And you don't have to start when you're 20, you know? So I learned a lot just from seeing her on the mat, and she just had such a presence. You know, the first time I met her, she had an ankle length leopard duster on and bright purple Doc Martens. And she's just kind of a boss, you know, she's in the room. And, so that was my first female black belt that I met. And she rolled, you know, she wouldn't roll with everyone. She was careful to pick her partners, which was something else I learned kind of right away watching her, because at the time I felt like, oh, I should just roll with anyone, you know? And then after her, I started competing to find women that were my rank and size, especially after purple belt. We had to do big competitions. We had to go to Worlds. We had to go to Pan Ams. And that was where I saw that kind of generation of black belts, you know, Michelle Nicolini, Kara Gracie, all those girls were out there just, I mean, at an extraordinary level, at a level that I didn't really know was possible, that I hadn't seen women roll at that level anyway. I'd seen guys. And so it was inspiring to watch them and give me something to shoot for.
Would you consider jiu-jitsu as a male-dominated sport? And I don't mean it as a negative way, but as a female entering an activity or a sport or an art where, you know, there's not many females, even today, training jiu-jitsu. There's a lot of them, but the percentages are, you know, kind of swaying towards the male.
Oh, yes, for sure. I would say it's about between 10 and 20% of the sport are female. And any given gym you walk into, it's going to be about 10 to 20% of the mm-hmm. population, unless they've really focused on it at that gym and gotten girls in there somehow. So yes, it's, you know, and it's physically, it's really hard. The other strange thing about jiu-jitsu is every other sport, you play soccer or rugby or basketball or hockey, there's a women's team and there's a men's team. And in jiu-jitsu, there's one class and an open mat, you roll with the guys, you know, and it's totally normal for our sport. You know, we don't think of it as anything strange, but it's not like that in any other sport. And you're expected to perform well against your male counterparts, you know, not only expected, but sometimes your rank depends on performing decently against the guys your size, and there's always a size and strength difference. So honestly, you have to be better.
Well, so let me ask you, is that a good thing or not? And I'll frame this way. We recently had Amy Campo on the show, and after mm-hmm. a phenomenal performance at ADCC, you know, she was talking about how training with men got her to where she is today, technically and physically, mm-hmm. mentally challenging, right? So, but what's your perspective on this? Is this a good thing that this is one group of individuals despite of the gender, or should there be separation like any other sport there is?
That's an interesting question. And side note, I've had one match against Amy and when she was a purple belt and I was a black belt, and it was like a no-gi, you know, it was like a Grappling Industries or something, and it was such a hard match. Like, she won both matches and I was like, what is happening? I just got beat, my ass handed to me by this, you know, super young purple belt. So I felt better watching her just wreck everyone, you know, on the way up. I was like, okay, maybe I just encountered someone who was just you know, going to be extraordinary. So that made me feel a little better, but she's very good.
There's levels to all this,
isn't it? And I do think you need to roll. Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And she, I imagine she started when she was young, but I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, so side note about Amy. So I do think it helps to roll with the guys. It makes your defense really good. And you have to be so technical because you're not going to win any transitions. You're always going to be a little bit slower, typically, if the guy's an athlete, you know, or if they're younger. You're going to be slower. You're not going to be able to force a transition if you're at all equal. You're going to lose all those transitions. So you have to be ahead of the person, either technique-wise or time-wise. And it makes you better, you know, to pull something off. You have to do it exactly the right time, or you have to be ahead. To develop your offense, though, you do need smaller partners, or you need female partners. I think, you know, it's very hard to replicate training for women with guys. They don't move quite the same way. They don't think the same way. I find my passing holds up much better against guys than it does against women. Women are more flexible in their guard, and they're used to being on their back. If they've come up in a gym that was, they were sparring a lot, they were training a lot with guys, their guard is so hard to pass, their guard retention, very hard to get their arms out. Like, they're so used to, you have to have develop arm discipline and protecting your neck so early as a female. Cause just, even just someone gets your sleeve, it's match ending. You're not going to get that arm back. You're not going to be able to yank your arm back. You're not going to be able to turn away from it. Like, you just lost because your arm was a little bit away from your body. And I think that's true for everybody once you get higher ranked, but, yeah, you just have to be, you have to be better. You have to be a little bit ahead. I think it makes it more realistic for self-defense. So I don't think it's a bad thing, but I'm a really strong advocate for schools having a women's only class. Like, even if it's once a week, just a chance for the girls to get together, especially white and blue belt girls. It's really hard to rank them and see their jujitsu unless they're going against other females. Like, a white belt match should look like back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And even blue belt, to some extent. But if you put a white belt female against a white belt guy, there's not a ton of technique, and the strength and size difference is enough, they'll just get pancaked. So you can't see if they even know what they're doing. So they need to be kind of allowed to, you either have to find a partner that allows them to work a little bit, or if you can watch them roll with another female, they can win a transition where they were close, but maybe the timing wasn't perfect. They can make an escape work where maybe they got flattened out first, but they can actually get back to their side and get back out. So it helps you kind of see where they're actually at.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because everything I'm hearing is, and let me challenge you a little bit on this topic.
Yeah.
Because everything you're explaining right now is considering that the individual has some knowledge of jiu-jitsu, even very basic but general knowledge, right? Would they know what passing looks like? They know about framing. They know how to react and move and balance and so on. But before we get to that point in our jiu-jitsu journey, there is a point of struggle for many, if not all of us. We get smashed, whether you're male or female. You get smashed, you get passed, you get submitted, and so on, right? And often conversation comes up with a new female students, you know, with a simple notion of, you know, I don't want to get destroyed by a bunch of guys because that's just, I'm not learning anything. So how does one get to that point of having some knowledge and basic defense mechanisms while they are struggling through these physical components that are being applied against them? I mean, how does one need to, do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. And that's more of a, I think that's just a universal white belt problem, but more if you're not super strong or if you're lighter, you know, and focusing on fundamentals, focusing on posture and learning to play guard defensively early. That's what I work on a lot with my newer girls, choosing partners carefully. You know, I tell them to stay within 25 pounds of their body weight if they can. Some of them, there's not even anyone on the mat that size. So I tell them to start there, and then with their bigger partners, have the bigger partner start and guard, and they work to pass. So both people are getting better. So you can kind of modify the open mat. It doesn't always have to be a match. That really helps. And then just focusing on, again, concept and keeping your body in a good position. You won't get injured as much. You'll stay safer, be able to breathe. And, you know, there's not so much that mental and physical feeling of getting smashed. You have to think about the technique. You can't roll instinctively, I don't think, when you're a smaller person.
Yeah, it's definitely harder, right? Because simply the gravity is just will get working against you, no matter how much you try. So what do you say to the ladies who, you know, come to your academy or to encounter with you and they just simply say, listen, I'm getting destroyed every single day. Like, this is not easy. You know, like, even Amy was talking about this, you know, like, she said that she didn't have any training partners who were size, who were her, you know, even females. They came a little bit later down the road, but it was a grind every single day. What's your perspective on that from a female perspective? How do you get ready?
You're going to have some ladies that can make it through that anyway. You know, they start and they're already fairly mentally tough, or they're athletes. You know, I came in, I was already an athlete. I was already, you know, not super tiny. I think when I started, I was around 165, 170 pounds, you know, so I wasn't tiny. And so that helps. And those people are going to make it anyway. They're going to make it in an all guys school. They're going to make it, they're going to figure out a way to train. Those are kind of your competitors, your top 10%. I wouldn't even say 10%. It's more like 3 to 5% of people who compete. Those people are going to be fine. So the Amy Campos, you know, myself, we have already built a level of frustration tolerance, have the mindset and the physicality to kind of survive in that environment. If they're coming in and they're not an athlete, you really have to, and they're small especially, really have to scaffold for that person so they're having some success right away. So I think a drilling class first is really important. They don't roll right away at our school. They have like 2 to 3 months of just drilling and learning the basics. Their first roles are with a coach, not just in the general population. We go over open mat etiquette, rules, when do you reset, how hard do you roll, how do you pick partners. I tell them they don't have to roll with everyone. You know, that's a rule at our school. Some schools, if an upper belt asks you, you have to roll, you know, and sometimes you get used as a rest round that way. And I think you should be able to, if you're paying to go to the academy, you should be able to choose your partners. You know, eventually you'll get to a point where you can roll with everyone. You can protect yourself. You know, for women, I think that's late blue belt, early purple belt. It's like, yeah, okay, you're going to be able to protect yourself, keep yourself safe from someone just landing on you or jumping on you or kind of pushing you in a way where you're like, oh, I'm off the mat for a few weeks now. So those are some things we do to kind of ease people in. We do have the women's only class as an advanced class, so they see other women participating, and we have women of all shapes and sizes now. You know, when I first started, it was me, the only girls that did it. We were doing MMA, we were competing. Those were the women that were making it. And now I have ladies that are older, smaller, heavier, taller, shorter. You know, we have everything. And I think that's a sign that the environment and the school has evolved. And those are the people that need it more. We want to make people who are weaker, less confident, stronger. And I think the benefits of jiu-jitsu should be open to everyone. If you're just making stronger people even stronger, then I don't think you're doing your job as a coach.
Yeah, it's definitely a very fine balance of embracing the skilled and strong individuals while you are building up the ones who need the help the most. That's one of the, I think, regardless of the gender, I think that's one of the big challenges that many coaches or instructors are running into. Who do you focus on? How do you cater towards them? Because, you know, I think it's difficult to cater towards both of them at the same time. Some separation probably here is desired, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I think you should have a competition team practice, you know, for those that outside that really want to go hard, that want to be doing those comp team rounds. Open mat is more for practice. Paul Sharp talked about drilling and structuring drilling at our last camp. I know he was on your podcast as well. And he talked about when someone's learning something new, they need to be successful about 80% of the time. And it depends on the individual a little bit, but if they're failing too much, more than that, they quit. And it's one of the reasons people don't make it past their first year in jiu-jitsu. So finding drills to kind of raise their success till they're feeling like they're having some success, and getting them to focus on really small goals. So not getting cross-faced for a whole practice, or, hey, I didn't get mounted the whole practice, you know, and maybe you're not winning a match and you don't win a match for a really long time. But I can remember when I first started getting really excited when I would almost sweep someone or like almost get out of a position, I would get so excited. And so you have to be able to celebrate those small wins or else you're not going to make it that long.
Yeah, but we both know that's easier said than done. I mean, like when, especially in the beginning of the journey when we are white belts, we just want to submit everybody. That's like the hyper focus of everything. Like I don't care what your belt you are, but I want to submit you. And it's so difficult to change that mindset. And Paul talked about it quite a bit. And I shared this very similar philosophy about this: small goals, small milestones, focus not on the submission, but focus on mechanics, focus on balance, you know, focus on your frames, you know, don't allow them to slide the knee across. Like the small victories is what really makes it successful. And once you get those, then life is much easier because those submissions and those sweeps, those reversals will just flow naturally. And it's so much, so much easier. Why do we focus on submissions so much?
It feels so good, right? That's finally true. Submit someone for the first time. Just chasing that high, right? It's amazing. I have some new guys right now on my evening class, and they just try submission from everywhere. Like, it's amazing to watch. It's kind of awesome because they don't know what's possible yet. So they try it from all these weird places, and sometimes it works, you know, on newer people, or you'll see them kind of like, man, I feel like that guy just invented something, you know, or rediscovered it.
it's like having the conversation about a clean choke versus a neck crank, you know, and like the counter response is, well, they tapped anyway. I was like, well, okay, but this is not what we are trying to achieve here, right? So it's always interesting to see these, you know, how our brains work as humans, because that's essentially what it is. We're going back to these kind of, you know, instinctive modes of win, of victory versus failure. And often submission is viewed as that, not necessarily as a result of what we're doing, but as the goal that we are chasing.
I think to be good at anything, you have to be process oriented, not outcome oriented.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Long-term focus. Jiu-jitsu is great that way because there's always something to learn. There's always some little detail, so you can be focused on the process, you know, if you're willing to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like the growth mindset, right? We're focusing on the grind itself, on the process, on exploring it, not necessarily what the outcome is. Let me pivot this conversation a little bit. You come from more traditional background, karate. Am I on the right track?
Yes.
Here?
Yeah.
How did that all
got start? A black belt in karate. My mom put me into a karate class when I was in high school. She actually got into it first, and it was her first outlet in a long time from having kids. You know, there were four of us at the time, and she was pretty busy with work and us. And so she started doing something for herself, which was good for me to watch. And I think it's important as a mother to have some time where you're not accountable to anybody else. So she started doing karate, and she put me and my sister in. And I was transitioning out of being a career high school athlete, you know, and I'd done some sport, multiple sports, you know, my whole life. And then you get into college, and unless you're going to play a college sport, which I really wasn't good enough at anything to make a college team, you kind of drop off the face of, you know, athletics, and you want something to fill that. And so I started doing karate. I found a club at my college and did it 4 years, got my black belt 4 years. And I finished school and I started moving around. I was for the Forest Service and some state park. Like, I was essentially a ranger, and I was on a trail crew for a while. I worked up in Alaska, and any little town that I went to, I would train in whatever martial art they had there. And I was kind of searching for, I felt like I needed something a little more functional. I've told the story before on some podcasts, but on my black belt test, there was a self-defense segment you had to do, and someone would throw a punch or a kick, and you had to defend yourself, but they would only throw one attack, typically just one punch. And then you'd do a bunch of cool stuff, around the person while they just stood there, and you're like, yeah, I'm so good at this, you know? And this one dude threw two punches. I don't like me that much, actually. And so I blocked the first one. And I was like, ah. And then the second one, he just punched me in the face. And I was like, ow.
That wasn't supposed
to
happen.
Man. I was like, I probably should be able to deal with like more than one punch, you know? So I had a black eye for my little test and I passed, but I didn't feel like I was very confident in that respect. And they did a little groundwork and a little throwing at that school. It's kind of a mixed style. And I really liked that part of it. So, you know, fast forward, I trained Aikido. I went to a Taekwondo school for a while, Kung Fu, different types of karate. And it was just a different system of katas, you know, performance, essentially, which is beautiful. You know, it's more of an art. It can keep you active. You can be around a really great group of people. Unfortunately, the system also lends itself to people who enjoy power and enjoy bullying. You know, there's a very strict social hierarchy in those schools, and you don't fight, you know, you don't spar. So you never have to kind of put your money where your mouth is, really. So you can have an instructor that's out of shape and is just yelling at students to do push-ups, and you're late, you know, 50 knuckle push-up on the wooden floor, you know, and things like that. And they're just kind of lording over these little schools, and they never get very big. And people cycle out that aren't willing to take that, but you're left with this core group of people that are like, yes, sensei, you know, and they can be kind of abusive. So I saw that over and over. I was like, man, I don't really like that. And then different katas, and the differences in forms and the way they were standing and the way they were punching, it had more to do with style than function. When I would ask, why do you do it that way? They'd say, because that's the way we've always done it. They don't really have a reason for a lot of it, or the reason would be so contrived. It was like, well, we can't practice that because it's too deadly and things like that. So I went to too deadly. You're going to hurt. I mean, you can't practice throat punches, you know, or eye gouges or groin strikes. You know, you can't practice that. But, you know, it's assumed that it would just drop someone. You know, you're making some pretty big leaps of logic. And I didn't feel super confident in it. And I happened to be in Alaska, and I was in a rec center up there, and they had all kinds of classes there. It gets real dark and wet in the spring and fall in Alaska. So they have like ballroom dancing and all kinds of different stuff. And they had a karate class. So I'm taking that. And then they had this other class that I thought was a Taekwondo class, and I ended up being an MMA class. So the first day I was wearing a white belt because I was super humble. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm a black belt, but I'm a white this style, you know? So I'd wear my white gi and my white belt, and everybody else was in board shorts and rash guard. We did this really hard cardio circuit. We did some boxing, which I had done point sparring, where you're like up on one leg, kind of noodle legging around, trying to like touch the person. And I was just, we weren't kickboxing. We're just boxing. I knocked off my feet, which I realized now wasn't great from the instructor. And then we did some grappling, and I was like, this is great. Like, actually got a workout, because a lot of these other classes, like I would go running after karate class because I'm like, I didn't get a workout. Like, the instructor talked half the time. I didn't sweat. I don't know what I learned today. And I was just feeling like I was wasting my time. So I was like, man, I'm tired. And that was really hard. And sometime within I was only up there for a few more weeks. Sometime up there did drill where we were working on escaping cross-eyes. And learned kind of a basic escape. I think it was just a knee elbow escape. And random people would show up for this class. It's like ex-wrestlers, random dudes that would just walk in. I was the only girl. And I ended up drilling. They put me with this teenage kid who was like maybe 15 or 16. And he was maybe 145 pounds, like soaking wet. But this kid had wrestled a little bit. And he pinned me for like the whole 2-3 minutes, whatever it was. And I did what every white belt does. I'm like, well, I'm going to try the move. And I'm like, move's not working. You know, he had his knee right in my hip. He was just on his knees and he had his arms on the other side, just like wrestler pinned. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know any submissions or anything, but I'm like, okay, no big deal. This kid's small and I'm a wilderness ranger and I'm pretty tough. So I'm just going to like shove him off me, you know? And so I start like really thrashing around and just trying as hard as I can. I could not get this kid off me. I was like, oh my gosh, like I've been just walking around by myself. You know, I've been traveling by myself, feeling pretty confident about my place in the world and, you know, my black belt and ranger and all this stuff. And I'm like, I just got held down by a child, essentially, like a little boy. And he's lighter than me. And he's not, you know, a state champion of Alaska wrestling. He did wrestling for like a year, you know, in middle school or something. And he just held me down the whole time. And there was nothing I could do about it. And I was like, oh my gosh. I'm like, okay, I've got to do more of this. And I ended up coming down from Alaska to Montana just as my instructor was opening his first school. So I got into a more legit school. They were doing gi, they were no gi. They were mostly MMA fighters. So it was me and kind of his guys that were fighting. And he built a really good culture. You know, it was very hard for me, but I never felt like I was going to get hurt. And he made sure everyone was respectful, you know, so it was actually a really first gym. You know, I was pretty lucky. And I was his first female student, you know, aside his wife kind of joined later. And the first woman I grappled was actually at a tournament. I didn't have a female training partner at the school, which I think was true for a lot of women at that time. There'd be like one, maybe two women pool. So, and then, you know, was snowboarding a lot, still doing some other stuff. And eventually, you know, kind of after that first year, I was still going back and forth between Alaska and Montana. And I kind of gradually got really hooked on it. You know, it gave you that feeling of flow that you can get from snowboarding, riding powder or surfing or something like that. And I was like, man, I'm liking this more and more. I'm getting a workout. I'm meeting awesome people. And I'm mentally really challenged. It was mentally so much harder than I thought it was going to be. It was mentally and physically just pushing me to my very limit. And I think it's hard to find something that does both. And I'd been really looking for that. I didn't realize quite what I was looking for. I was looking for something functional, but I was also looking for a practice, you know? And so I tried all these different styles. I even ended up in, there was a little judo program up there, but they only did kata. They did, you would set up and do the throw. They didn't spar. And I watched the instructor spar. The instructor sparred one day. I'm like, when do we get to do that? And they're like, you don't get to do that. Like, what are we doing then? I'm like, what are we doing? Like, when do we get to fight each other? And so, yeah, got my chance.
So tell me a little bit more about that day with that teenager. You spend, tell me, how many years do you have behind, at that point of time? How many years of experience do you have with martial arts?
At that point, I was probably, you know, 4 really dedicated years and then maybe another year of kind of trying some different ones, doing Aikido. You know, my mom was a black belt in Aikido and karate. So she was really into this stuff. So when I would go home from college, you know, for a month or whatever, I would train with her and I would get so mad in those classes. Because Aikido, your partner has to be very cooperative. So if a guy doesn't want you to throw them and they don't really jump into it, like you don't get to do it.
So you have 5 years of some kind of martial arts here and there. And 4 of those 5 is really dedicated and significant investment from time perspective. And at least what I'm hearing from you, there is a certain level of confidence that followed those 5 years. Like I can hold my own. I mean, I have the black belt. And you know, there's a skill that I'm holding up. And then yet, there's this moment where your skills are being challenged. And, you know, things don't go according to plan. You're put in this position of, you know, in this circumstance that is making you rethink things, essentially. From this point on, you look at this from a completely different perspective. You're looking for something else. You know, what has happened? What is that trigger during that time, during that match, when you are pinned by that young gentleman? What's going through your mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted the technique we learned to work, you know, but when you're having students drill a knee elbow escape, you know, getting your knee to your partner's hip, you have to instruct the person on top not to immediately block that hip. Otherwise, it's just never going to work, you know? And so this kid had his knee in my hip, his elbow in my hip. So he was really kind of paying my hips. But was still chest to chest enough. You know, he was kind of 45 degrees a little bit. He was doing a good job. And yeah, I didn't get out once, you know, and the instruction was very informal at best. We'll say that, you know, it was just kind of a loose group of students. Yeah. There was one person who was a purple belt, had had some fights, so he knew a little more, but there was no instruction on how to drill. So this kid did his very best to hold me down, and I did my very best to get out, and consequently, like, I didn't get out at all. But it was kind of good because again, partway through, I was like, okay, the escape's not working. I'm just going to try to push him or sit up, you know, just kind of roll him over. And I tried all those things. And I was so, I remember being totally exhausted at the end of it. And it was probably only 2 or 3 minutes. It seemed like a really long time.
Yeah.
So I actually couldn't get out. And there's a little bit of panic. I mean, even though he wasn't heavy, he wasn't even heavier than me, but I was like, I can't get this kid off of me. And I started laughing. Because I was like, this is ridiculous. I was like, I can't get out. This poor kid, I mean, I remember him telling me, he's like, I have to be a little careful. I broke my femur playing football. And I was like, that's so awful. You're so, like, how did you break a femur? So he was just, I mean, he was relatively small and, like, kind of fragile. And he's like, be careful with me, you know. And then he just held me down the whole time. Like, oh, no.
But yet, very eye-opening moment, right?
Yes, it was pivotal. It was pivotal for sure. I didn't realize that. And I had kind of a similar awakening when I tried to lift weights for the first time. And I always thought of myself as an athlete or thought of myself as pretty strong, but I never really had a dedicated strength and conditioning program. And I realized, I think about how weak structurally I was when I first started, and I'm amazed I didn't have more injuries. Like, I was just kind of throwing down, and I wasn't lifting or doing anything else. I was just rolling all the time. And I did have some significant injuries, but yeah. So another kind of like, wow, I'm not actually very strong, and I'm not actually as skilled as I thought I was. And I guess I better work on this, you know?
Well, and that actually, that statement brings me right to the point to the next question I wanted to ask you, because I do believe that a lot of people would quit at that moment. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would say, I just wasted 5 years of my life. Screw this. This is not worth my time. This is not worth my effort. I just wasted money, time, all that stuff, and I can't even push this teenager off of me. And they would just walk away and be done with it, right? But yeah, you are seeking different answers. So why?
Yeah. I guess it was, I mean, it was partly the time invested. I had these beautiful kicks that I could hit pads, and I would win kata competitions, you know, and we would do these choreographed self-defense routines with my friends, which was super fun. It was like a movie fight scene, you know, and we'd win these tournaments, and then some random guy, you know, at that test, he punches me twice, like 1-2, nothing extraordinary or unpredictable. And I'm like, man, I just got punched right in the face. And I was like, I should be able to deal with that. So I wanted the tools at that point. I wanted some self-defense tools. And I was getting live feedback for the first time. You don't work with partners very much in traditional martial arts. You do in Aikido, but it's very cooperative. It's all based on sword movements. Mm-hmm. So all the attacks are very linear,
yeah.
And they're thrust based, or, you know, you have to do it this way. You have to do, and if you're not attacking correctly, you'll be corrected over and over and the technique won't work. So this was the first time I was like, I feel like this is live, you know, getting real feedback, and I'm understanding what works and what doesn't work and what size of person what I can deal with, and what the strength difference really is between men and women. Cause you don't really know. I mean, you don't mix with men's sports coming up through high school. So I'd never like wrestled around with a guy or like pushed and pulled. Like, I just didn't understand the strength difference at all, you know, until I started doing that sport. And so a little bit for myself, a false sense of confidence, you know, maybe some women don't, but I thought I was kind of a badass. You know? So you see people make that decision. As a coach, I watched and I get held down like that, or have that like really rough role, beat up by the kind of nerd assassin at the school, you know, some like skinny little guy or girl, just purple belt or whatever, that'll just mop the floor with the big new white belt. And you watch him and you're like, okay, this is the night. That guy's either going to quit and never come back, or they're going to be back and they're going to be working twice as hard because they realize the deficit, you know? So they have to make a decision, and they have to have some frustration tolerance to do that. And that's something they may have built at that point if they're an adult. And if they haven't, a lot of times we don't see them again. You know, for the kids, we can kind of help them build that. But for the adults, they remove themselves from the environment. You know, the kids don't really have a choice.
Well, yeah, I mean, with kids, it's slightly different, because if you can have that conversation with the parent and lean on the parent to continue that bringing them back, you can work with them with adults is as simply as not getting off the couch, you know? So it's by far more difficult to make this impact on adult people, especially if the impact, the psychological impact of that role was, you know, well, let's just be honest. Our egos get bruised. You know, we have a lot of pride as humans, you know, and sometimes those challenges just don't, you know, they don't work well for some, you know? So,
no, I had a guy, in the early days of the school, I finally learned the whole position a little bit. All the other guys were way ahead of me. They'd been wrestling, doing MMA, you know, and we had some new people come in finally. And I held this guy down and mount for, you know, a whole round, similar to that little kid, you know, that held me down. And the guy got up after the round, and it was an open mat round, but I didn't know any submission. So I just held him and mount, you know, most of the match. And he got up, got his gym bag, and started walking out. And my coach, Travis, is like, "You all right?" And he's like, "Yep, totally fine." Never came back. He just walked out the door, just grabbed his bag, like in the middle of open mat, and just left. And we're like, "Okay, well, see you never, I guess." You know, you have a choice. It's hard.
It is hard. Jiu-jitsu is hard, but it also, you know, Gary says this often, but we can do hard things. We can. It is a lot of it is up here, you know, how we approach life, how we approach jiu-jitsu, how we approach situations. And, you know, nothing good comes out from quitting. You just.
Not usually not. Yeah. You know? It did take me a lot more years, I feel like, to deal with that more than one punch, you know? So I got my black belt in jiu-jitsu and I still didn't totally feel comfortable with someone throwing strikes at me. So I ended up doing MMA. I did a couple MMA fights. And after that, I did it for, you know, like 2 or 3 years. And after that, I was like, okay, I finally feel like I'm okay. If someone decides they want to punch me in the face or try to grab a hold of me, I feel much better about it now.
Well, and I think you bring up a very good point. I mean, jiu-jitsu is not all about, even though it is self-defense oriented, it doesn't necessarily always get you ready for the street fight, right? And a lot of that really comes from what kind of program are you part of. I think today there is a little bit more diversity with jiu-jitsu academies, where they do teach no-gi, gi, some street self-defense, some striking, and so on. We have these opportunities to engage in many ways. But, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was starting 20 years ago, the jiu-jitsu was completely different. You know, academies were completely different. The approach to teaching was like black and white to what we have today. I often tell my students that they are spoiled in a sense how easy accessible jiu-jitsu is today. I know that. Like Gary and I, we talked about this often on this show, but like, you know, 20 years ago, when you saw a blue belt or purple belt, it was like, oh my God. He's like, bow to that guy. Where's the roll carpet? Like, you want coffee, anything, just show me anything, because you're like, that was unheard of. You know, it's like today is so much easier to do that. To gain some of that knowledge. And I think also, I'm curious of your perspective. I think from a teaching perspective, as instructors, we have more access to more intelligent data. I think instructors are getting smarter too. They teach differently. They really embrace the studying part of it, not necessarily just spitting out 10 steps and memorizing them. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think like coaching's gotten better, and just you have access to, you can watch all the matches that you can handle. You know, it's all recorded now. And I mean, you can YouTube totally. Yeah. Just so many videos out there, just libraries of technique. Yeah. I can remember when we were up in Alaska. I went down to Montana. I worked in Montana in the winter, summer, and we went up to Alaska, and I said, "Travis, I'm going to be back in this rec center. What can I do to keep training? You know, I'm not sure what instructor is going to be there." And he said, "You need to buy this DVD series." So I had Matt Thornton's Functional JKD 1, which was basically jiu-jitsu, but with some MMA. It was kind of jits with hits. Yeah. And so we were in the rec center. I remember I had the computer on a folding chair, and we would like sit and watch the escape stuff and then like try to do it. And we were learning from these DVDs, and it was like, oh my gosh, like a folding chair and some panel mats, you know, just making it happen. And then, yeah, now it's like, you can YouTube, you can order mats to your house, you know, it's just, it's all there. I do think there was also a mentality to weed out people who weren't strong.
Yes.
If they can't handle it, they can't handle the first day, they're going to walk out, they're going to tap to cardio or position. We don't want them at our school. And and they would be kind of bullied out. And it was always small. You know, every academy was really small, and kind of flipped that now. And now we have, you know, we have kids, we have women, we have older people, younger people. And we still have that hardcore group that are competing, but they help the other people instead of trying to, you know, impose their game or practice, use them as practice dummies, or, you know, show them that they're not quite strong enough, you know. Instead it's the opposite, which I think is really, I think that's a really good thing.
Well, that allows for the sport to grow, for the art to grow, for jiu-jitsu just continue exploding the community mindset. I mean, I said this so many times, you know, throughout the episodes. Like, I remember being a white belt and being at the academy, and I was told flat out, you will never get your black belt. If you're here for the black belt, might as well just go home right now. Like, you'll never get it. Doesn't matter. You will never get that. Like, you know, but it was that kind of mentality of, listen, you got to suck it up. You got to grind it. You got to work hard. And if you can't keep up with it, you can't. So, like, get that mindset out of your head. This is not why we do this. And today, I think it's by far more approachable. Right. As you mentioned, like, I mean, I have a couple 60-year-old students in my academy and I love it. Like, can they hang with a 20-year-old wrestler? Absolutely not. But that's not the point. Sometimes the older guys are more technical than the younger guys. And that's the beauty behind it. It's, I don't know. So you come from a science education.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about that. That was fascinating. As I was doing research, getting ready for this conversation, I stumbled upon that. What is science education? What does that mean?
Well, I did my undergraduate degree was in biology, and then graduate degrees. I have more than one science-based education degree, which is silly, but I did that. And the first one was geared toward environmental education. So out of that, I ended up working in Alaska and doing, we had the Wilderness Ranger program there where we would sea kayak around and we would board cruise ships and do nature programs. And then we would also do some trail work and wilderness site monitoring and wildlife monitoring. Kind of environmental education. I did avalanche safety education in Montana and worked for Portland Audubon Society for a while. I ended up moving to Portland and training with Matt Thornton, who's the head of Straight West Gym, the Portland gym, for 4 years. I moved from Travis's gym in Montana to there for a few years to finish a classroom education degree because the economy had crashed in 2008. And I was like, man, environmental education suddenly got really hard. Maybe I'll do classroom. So I got my classroom teaching certificate. And it just wasn't a great fit for me. I was like, I just put myself back in a high school schedule and I'm in a classroom all day and the kids don't want to be there. And, you know, when you're doing environmental education, you come in and you're a rock star. You know, you're like, look, I brought you a bunch of dead birds to look at. And the kids are like, yeah, you know, or like, look, here's a live owl. And they're like, great, you know, or I would do, you know, sleepaway camps in Portland to Audubon with middle schoolers. And we'd go out for a week. I got to see a lot of Oregon that way, up to Mount St. Helens or down to Bend. And they're experiential learning, hands-on learning, seeing the science, seeing the organisms that you're talking about. And it's so much more powerful and they remember it so much better and they are learning and they have a, I don't know, it's a really awesome way to teach science. And then you go in a classroom and it's so sterile and you're just looking at books and it's compulsory. So a lot of them don't want to be there, which for some reason I didn't anticipate because I loved science in high school, but
I mean, it's pretty clear that you enjoy outdoor education and science, but yet in jiu-jitsu, we are clearly indoors. I mean, there's only few opportunities to train outside. You know, do you find that boring as well?
It was a big switch for me. It kind of happened a little at a time. You know, if anyone who's gotten really into jiu-jitsu, it kind of eats your other hobbies a little bit at a time, you know, until you're just like, you know, I got super focused on it for a while. So I was always doing both at first, you know, in the winter snowboarding and doing jiu-jitsu, in the summer hiking or paddling, you know, doing whatever, getting outside. And then I focused on competition for about 4 years in Montana. I'm like, I'm just going to do this full time. You know, I went away from classroom teaching. Travis told me, I have a full-time position for you. If you want to work full-time, just compete and, you know, see what you can do. As I was a black belt at that point, I'm like, all right, I'm going to push this as hard as I can and just see what kind of competition results I can get. See how far I can take it. And so then it was very intensely, like pretty much just that, you know, and I was in the gym 7 days a week, you know, just grinding, just kind of doing that. And I achieved what I wanted to, you know, with the sport. I felt like I took it as far as I could have. And then now I've transitioned into more coaching and I'll compete in the Masters division. I'll do super fight for there if I have an opportunity, but I'm integrating back in the outdoor hobbies. And I've gotten really excited about hunting lately. My husband is pretty into it. So I've gotten the opportunity to go out and rifle hunt the last few years. And I'm learning how to bow hunt, how to shoot a bow. And so it's like, I'm a white belt again, like total newbie. And it's getting me outside and it's a lot of fun and it's really hard too.
So let me get this straight. So you went from outdoor education indoor to teaching jujitsu, and then you were hunting people inside on the mat, and now you're getting outside hunting. You see the connections?
Predatory, very predatory. Yeah.
So, but as you look at the education part, you know, you spend some time outdoors, you spend some time indoors, and now obviously for the last several years you are involved in teaching jujitsu, educating people of jujitsu. Do you find any common denominators, any common things that, you know, translate between outdoor teaching, indoor teaching, or classroom teaching, and then what's happening on jujitsu? Has that helped you at all with being an instructor, efficient instructor?
Oh, yes. It helped me a lot. You know, I'd had, you know, 15 to 20 years of teaching experience before I started teaching jujitsu. I'd taught snowboarding from when I was 16, did it for like 16 seasons. And so being in front of a group, you know, the public speaking aspect helps, but then creating a lesson plan and making it cohesive and memorable, it has to be able to be intuitive enough where they can connect the dots there. And also later on to be able to remember it. If you teach things that are too fragmented or unrelated, they can't remember it. I had a snowboarding training one time and they put a slide up and it said, it doesn't matter what you teach, it only matters what the students learn. And it can be easy as an instructor to get out and do kind of a jujitsu guitar solo and you're like this and this and this and this and this, and then if you have the class do it and no one remembers, or the next week you ask them to do it and no one remembers to do anything, it doesn't matter, you know, you totally failed, even if it was a really cool lesson to you. So you have to read the room, and that takes a lot of practice. And you have to, the thing that's great about jujitsu is you get immediate feedback. And it's kind of like that with experiential education or outdoor education. You can illustrate a geological concept and then be like, look, that's the result of it. It's right in front of us. We can see the evidence of it. It's evidence-based learning. And science is evidence-based. Jujitsu is like that too. Does it work? Let's test it. Let's pressure test it. Let's do it with a partner. Now let's put an open mat, you know. If something is failing consistently, it might not be valid. Or maybe you're the only one who can do that. Maybe it's just something that's in your game. You have to try not to teach your style, you know, try to teach the concepts and the fundamentals, teach people how they work. They can think critically and develop a style of their own.
So do you think teaching jujitsu is easy, or is that really a complex skill for one to learn?
It's gotten easier. I think as long as you start fundamentals. So you teach them in our gym, we teach the posture and the pressures first. So what big shape should your body be in? What position do you have to be in as a basis to make the rest of what you're going to do work? If you're in the wrong position and you try to pull off a move, doesn't, so we work on the posture and, you know, what pressure are we applying to ourselves, to the mat, to our partner to make this work? And then we add the possibilities from there. The style, the movement, you know, the movement pathways. And it gives people an anchor that can kind of go back, okay, this is at least the shape body should be in. And here's my big goal from that position. And then if I can remember some of the moves later, that's great.
What would you say is the hardest thing about teaching jiu-jitsu?
The hardest thing, it's actually really challenging in some ways to, I would say there's two ends of the spectrum. A brand new beginner. If a lot of people don't teach new people anymore. And I taught our foundations class for quite a while, which is people's first experience. And I teach, you know, I teach kids every week. So I also have new kids coming in. And when someone's never seen a shrimp, like ever, getting them that movement or a technical get up, you know, some things that we really take for granted are just so foreign, you know, getting a 5-year-old to do a technical get up. It's like, they barely know where their arms and legs are. So you wouldn't have to actually like put their arms and legs in the right position or like pull them up by their gi jacket the first time so they can stand up without falling over, and really working hard to get them to do those fundamentals. And once they kind of can do those line warm-ups, forward roll, backward roll, shrimp, you know, technical get up, the rest of it becomes easier. But those few things, the first like month or two are really challenging, and really challenging for adults too. So that's tough. And then the other end, I would say, are the more intermediate players. So you get like blue or purple belt, and they decide that they know all the jiu-jitsu.
Oh, because
and
they
it's that Dunning-Kruger effect, where as an intermediate, you know just enough where you have like 70% success, you know, or 80%, you're like, I'm really good at this. And it's like the most dangerous phase. And a lot of people don't make it past that because they just stop learning and they don't focus on the process. They just focus on the outcome. And they just want to teach everyone. They're like, well, let me tell you how I do it. Mm-hmm. You know, or they're teaching their partners. They're talking more than they're training. Those are the ones that are like just showing up for open mat, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, and sometimes when they're in my class, and I'm sure you've experienced this, you look over and they're doing something totally outside the drill.
Oh my God.
And like maybe their partner knew that was going to happen, or maybe not.
don't even start me on this. Don't. Like sometimes sometimes I like pull my hair out. It's like I appreciate creativity. I love when students are creative and they experiment and all this. But like I don't know, hypothetically, we talk about, let's just say, half guard passing. Okay, and like here are 3-4 options, blah blah blah. I want you to experiment. And then the moment they are like upside down in the back control doing some kind of funky things, and I was like, how even you even got here? This is not even remotely related. Like you just went 7 other ways. Like what is going on here? Oh, we were just trying things. And
yeah,
my students are probably listening to this right now and they are rolling their eyes because they exactly know who I'm talking about.
Well, it's so crazy. So we went to Origin Camp this year in Maine, which is a huge jiu-jitsu camp. So they had 350 people there this year. They're doing 500 next year.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy.
I mean, we've had the Deco on the show, and it's such a phenomenal group of people. I love
the Deco's the best. Yeah.
He's such a character. I love him.
They're great. So to accommodate that many people, you're splitting by belt level. So there's a white belt room, there's a blue and purple belt room, and there's a brown and black belt room. And the instructors actually fight over who gets to teach the white belt. They all want to teach the white belt, which is actually, I thought that was so cool.
That is cool.
Because they're so excited to learn, and the white belt, they're like, how can I do it exactly like you? And they're trying so hard. And the black belts and the brown, they're like, how can I do it just like that? I'll figure the rest out later. I'll put my own spin on it later, you know, or integrate it in my game. Then you go to the blue and purple belt room, and one of these guys would show something. And these guys have been doing jiu-jitsu for like 35 to 40 years, like Laborio. I mean, he's been on the mat forever. And they show something. You get knowledge directly from that person. And they're like, that's cool. But what if I did this?
Yeah,
and
exactly. The what if comes in. Yeah.
And people are like, I mean, they teach a sweep and people are in footlocks, they're in back control. Like you look across the room and it was just like any number of nonsense happening. And it was like everybody's least favorite, you know, just because there are, and that's, I would say it's about a quarter of the room. Like if there's 100 people in there, I would say about 25 or 30 are just doing something random. Or I would come by and they'd be like, I have a question. Do you think this would work? And I'm like, let me help someone who's actually working on the technique we're doing. Like you can figure out if that works later on your own. Like that, I can tell you how many times that happened in that room. I'm like, what are you doing right now? You know? And you're wasting your instructor time and your time. Like, do that later up by yourself and open that, you know? And so there were a percentage of people that were doing what they were trying to do the technique, trying to help their partner. But then there were a bunch that were like, and it was just random partners. So sometimes their other partner was just getting taken for a ride. They're like, this isn't what we're doing, but somehow I'm in a footlock. And it's just like, oh my gosh.
But do you think do you think we all go through that stage of curiosity and experimentation and I don't know, just go crazy YouTube like vortex, you know, nonsense, you know, despite what our instructors tell us. I mean,
I think you should at blue or purple belt, but there's a time and a place for it. Like, right. Do it on your own practice time. Don't do it in class while you're taking up your partner's time too, and use their drill time to go on your weird tangents. You know, that's what I don't appreciate. And also sometimes they don't know what's happening. If it's a newer person, they're like, I don't know what's happening right now. They can get hurt in an extreme case. But yeah, that's the other hard group to teach are those intermediate. Everybody goes through it.
I agree. And like I said, I appreciate creativity, but there's one more factor behind this, I guess, like a little trigger for me personally is like, I always look at situations like this and it's like, you don't do a simple cross choke correctly, but yet you want a Baron Bolo. Like that's what bothers me. It's like, if you are really efficient on everything that we need to do, then please go explore, knock yourself out, you know? But like, I don't know. I don't want to turn this into a venting session, but you know exactly what I mean, right?
Yeah. at a certain point though, I mean, to be a devil's advocate, you have to find something that you're interested in about the sport, you know? And for some people, they're like, oh, this is just too mundane for me. Like, I don't want to work on the fundamentals. I want to work on this really weird footlock entry or this crazy inverted move. And you're like, okay, if that keeps you showing up and your spine can handle it, like, go for it, you know? So, I mean, I see it to some extent, but if they're ignoring their fundamentals, they end up with this really asymmetrical game and they don't perform very well. And that can have an expiration date, I think. You have these, I think, mini revelations of like how good you are too. You know, you get to like purple or brown and you're like, oh man, I'm pretty good. You know, I'm doing okay in my own gym. And if you compete, I think you'll have it faster because you're going to run into people that just walk through you because there's just levels and levels, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I really didn't have my guard passed in competition until I got to black belt. But then it was like, come on down. You know, it's just like it happened so many times. Like it happened more than once in a match. You know, a girl would be like, oh, this pass worked. I'll just do it again. I'll back up and do it again to score more points. You know, and I was like, I can't believe this is happening. But I think especially at black belt, it's like you're starting over, but you have to make it over that hump, you know, that past that purple belt and either get exposed to someone who's that much better than you or compete. You know, you have to be looking for it, I guess, and not avoiding hard roles because you'll see people do that at that level too. They want to roll with people they know they can beat. And if there's someone who's close to their level or better, they're like, oh, I'm done for the day, bro. Like, I don't need to roll with that guy who's better than me. I'm just going to sit back and teach this guy over here. He wants to learn something from me, you know?
Yeah, that's always interesting dynamic too, you know, when we turn down the hard roles. And I don't mean the physically hard roles, but like technical. Yeah. I personally think that the technically challenging roles are like more ego bruising than the physical roles. You know what I mean? Like when you get demolished, you just got demolished. Like it's just like black and white. Okay. All right. I just got pancaked. It is what it is. But when somebody makes quote unquote fool out of you, you know what I mean? They just toy with you. That's just ego bruising. Oh, that's awful. Yeah.
Oh. Those are the ones where you think about driving home just with radio off, looking straight ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. You can hear your thoughts out loud and it's like, oh, you those are the best times. I think this is why I love jiu-jitsu. I don't know.
Yeah. Keep coming back. There's always someone. Yeah, it's make you feel like, oh my gosh, I thought I was figuring this out, but apparently there's 10 more steps above me. And keeps doing it.
Yeah, no. But that's the beauty behind it. No, you know, once we get an answer, there is another question. There's another obstacle. Mm-hmm. And those who can overcome these obstacles and can troubleshoot it in a way where it makes sense and really logically create some kind of web, logic web behind all of this, those are the ones who stick around. And it is unfortunate, but, you know, not many do make past the blue belt and not many really make up to that black belt. I mean, I think it's more today than it was 20 years ago, but still percentages are very small, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but definitely more. More are making it, and more different ages and sizes. We just had a camp in Boise, Idaho, where Paul's based out of now, and Matt awarded 3 black belts, and 2 were small female MMA fighters, which was really cool. Stephanie Hernandez, the pro fighter at 109. And,
oh, yeah, 109, that's
Vita, little, yeah. Yeah, Vita fights for Bellator, I think at 125. And they both got their black belts. And then Dr. John Hobson got his black belt. And I think he's in his 60s. And he was a medical doctor, you know, and started really late in life. But he's gnarly as hell. I mean, tall, tough guy to deal with. And they got their black belts on the same day. And it was like they couldn't be more different, you know, tiny, tiny females that were, you know, younger, still active competitors. And then Dr. John, who's, you know, now he's teaching and just he decided this was going to be a sport as he got older, and equally as technical and gnarly and great knowledge base, but just totally different body, totally different people. And I think that shows the evolution of the sport, not who would have been up there 8 years ago, even. Mm-hmm. So I think it's awesome.
No, and I agree. I mean, like, as I mentioned earlier today, I have, you know, 60 plus student here who is a black belt recently awarded year ago, 2 years ago. And we had Betty Bruthurst on a show as well. And I mean, she's in her, I don't want to throw a number out there, but she's not, you know, there was a little mileage on that young lady. You know what I mean? It's like, it is what it is. And she's hanging in there. She's competing and mopping the mat with everybody. So good for her. I love that story. So what I think as jiu-jitsu continues evolving, we will have more and more of those opportunities for many people to join in and enjoy this beautiful sport that we have. Listen, Leah, we've been at this for an hour almost. Well, yeah, no, it's actually an hour.
Right.
Yeah. Before we end, and at the end of every episode, we have a question from a previous guest that we had on the show. And Dan Hart asked a question I'm going to throw at you right now, and it's going to create an interesting, it's going to create an interesting ending to the show. His question is, what is that one attribute that makes someone more likely to achieve a black belt?
One attribute. So I would say the self-discipline to stay consistent. So consistency and routine. Consistency and routine, just being able to continue to come to practice and focus on their learning each day. Those people who train 6 or 7 days a week when they first start, they rarely are able to keep that up. They hit about blue belt, and that's where you get the blue belt blues, and you see the blue belts just, oh, you're like, oh, that guy was so awesome. I thought he was going to be a coach, and he competed, and he was so awesome. Like, he was a good part of the community, and they just kind of just drift away, you know, because it's too much. And then I've got my guys that are just like clockwork, 2, 3, maybe 4 days a week, and they're there every week. They let me know when they're not going to be there, and they're not getting better as fast as those other guys, but they're going to stay longer. They're going to stick around longer. So I would say consistency over volume.
If
that's the biggest thing.
If you had to pinpoint the amount of times per week that one should train to create that consistency without the burnout over a longer period of time, what would it be for you?
Mm-hmm. I think the minimum is 2 days a week, 2 hours rolling, 2 hours drilling. So do a class and stay for an hour open mat, like stay for the whole time, make every roll. My kind of prime example of that would be Kane Prios, who's a really high level instructor out of the Portland gym. Again, you know, I think he started when he was 40. also had a traditional martial arts background, and then went to a jiu-jitsu school that wasn't that great and kind of got tuned up when he came to our school. So had that revelation twice, unfortunately for him. Mm-hmm. But, was a high school teacher, had a family, never wanted to train more than 2 days a week. So he was always a hobbyist. And that was, he even highlighted it at camp, because he taught at camp at the Boise camp. He said, all these other people up here have been competitors at some point or are gym academy owners. And he's like, I'm a coach, I'm a teacher, and I'm a hobbyist. But he's really influenced our teaching style because he was such a great teacher, you know, in terms of lesson plans and drilling types. And I always thought about it. You know, I apprenticed coached under him. So I learned, we co-taught together for a couple years, and I learned a lot from him. He really influenced my abilities as a teacher, and I had that extra support on the mat. You know, I didn't just teach by myself to begin with. And he never trained more than 2 days a week, and he got his black belt in 10 years, you know, which is totally normal. And he thought about it a lot. He would write about it. You know, he transitioned from train twice a week, enrolling 2 hours, to teach twice a week, enrolling 2 hours. And he was able to do it. So I think that's the slow, steady. And if you can do three, that's great. But two, he did two, and he was good. You know, I mean, he made the most of his time there. There's another black belt, Eddie Ziegler, that was pretty similar, very active, full family life. And he would make it two, maybe 3 days a week. You might see him on a weekend. He got to black belt fast too. I mean, he put a squat bar out office and was lifting, you know, on his lunch breaks out by the dumpster in the office. You know, ended up doing some MMA too. You know, he thought about it outside of the gym, but his actual hours in there, you know, he would meditate or get on the mat, step onto the mat, and be really focused for that hour or 2 hours, and just really have a learning goal instead of just kind of showing up and unconsciously rolling. You know, I think sometimes when we're there a lot, you're just going through the motions and you're not necessarily improving for that time. So being efficient, I guess, with your hours instead of volume can be really effective for hobbyists. And then you keep balance with your family, your other hobbies. Like, it doesn't have to take over. It can, and it can be beautiful, and it can be a lot of fun, but it can also cause a lot of problems with family and friends, or just, you know, make it so you're not doing other things. And that's usually not sustainable, I find, for most people.
Well, I think it's just like with everything else, you know, it's the fine balance of keeping it steady, you know, in anything in life, you know, and a balanced amount is good. Overdoing it is what kills us, right? Overdoing it is what really destroys the whole thing, and it really drags everything down altogether. But you mentioned something really important, I think, that really hit me, is that older I get, you know, as I continue going through this and teaching and running academy, is that quality is important, not quantity. It's not necessarily being on the mat 7 times a week, but being on a mat 3 times a week or 2 times a week with focused goals, with focused, you know, something that we aim for, having milestones, continue checking the boxes off, and continue drawing something that we can tangibly continue growing. Getting, it's just, you know, it's not learning necessarily, but it's education, being smart about it. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Yep. Being really present when you're there, being really focused. So just, you know, and it's a good thing you leave everything when you step on the mat, but just letting go of that internal monologue other than just what's right in front of you, you'll feel better after you leave too, but you'll get a lot more out of your training. If you're thinking of things, you're distracted, you're not able to clear your head, that's going to show up in your practice.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Leah, thank you for being here. Thank you for the last 60 minutes of fabulous conversation. Thank you for sharing your experience with us. If anybody wants to connect with you, where they can find your social media, websites, I mean, talk about that briefly. And we'll, as always, we'll post all the links in the show notes of this episode. But, you know, share with us. Where are you at?
I'm at CoachLeahBJJ.com. And you can book seminars through there. I take phone calls, and there are some resources, a link to my blog there. And within my blog, you can find, I wrote a manual on how to create your own women's program. So there's curriculum there, how to get more women in your gym, how to keep them. Don't have to have a female instructor, but it literally does it step by step. I've helped start a women's gym at more than one academy, and that's free. You can just download it. It's 13 pages. It's like 14 years of jujitsu and coaching distilled into 13 pages. And it's a resource that's out there. So if you want to start a women's program, get more ladies in your gym, it's half the population outside gym. So it makes sense. That's available. And I have a blog where I answer a lot of really common jujitsu questions, or if you have any questions, feel free to shoot me a message. You can direct message me on Instagram at Leah Stump, SBG. And I try to answer all of them. So if you have questions, I can answer it in a blog or answer it on there. And I think those are two of the best ways to reach me.
Absolutely. Well, phenomenal. Once again, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing your knowledge, your experience, your story with us. And we will be watching you from sidelines as you continue, as we all continue this beautiful journey of jiu-jitsu.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Raw Radio. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review and help us make the show even more amazing. For future episodes, check out our website and follow us on all major podcast platforms. Take care.